Well, the bats reappeared last night, and Tiger fans keep the faith for another day here as we are set to take on the Red Sox again tonight. Game 5 at Comerica Park with the series tied and guaranteed of a return to Boston and a need to win one game in Boston. But quite an eventful night last night. We can just hope that the bats and the pitching hold up tonight as well as they did last night. Coming up later this hour, singer Johnny Mathis is coming to the Wharton Center soon. We visit with some students in Eaton Rapids who are studying the Kristallnacht, which was a horrendous event leading up to World War II back in the 30s. And we also visit with Lansing's two new inductees into the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame. Joan Jackson Johnson and Dr. Paula Cunningham will join us here in just a few minutes. At the top of the show, as of today, Michigan's ban on same-sex marriages remains in place. Yesterday, U.S. District Judge Bernard Friedman chose to hold a trial in February in the case in which a lesbian couple from Hazel Park is seeking to overturn the state's laws that prohibit same-sex couples from marrying and entering into joint adoptions. Here in Ingham County, Judge Friedman's announcement left many same-sex couples jilted at the courthouse in Mason as they were expecting him to overturn the marriage ban and pave the way for them to be legally married. Joining us by phone is Ingham County Clerk Barb Byram, who was prepared to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples yesterday. Thanks for joining us, Barb.
Thank you so much for having me.
What was the scene like at the courthouse in Mason yesterday afternoon?
You know, yesterday afternoon we started the day full of hope and love that our state would finally be a state of equality. And we finished that day the same way. Even though our hearts broke for our LGBT friends, family, and neighbors, we still are full of hope and love.
Yesterday aside, what has the interest level been like at your office these past few days or weeks?
Oh, I have been contacted by many couples over the past few weeks. And in fact, I had over 20 couples ready to be married if given the opportunity yesterday. So there's a lot of interest in our state finally recognizing that all people are equal and we shouldn't have any second-class citizens in our state.
When did that interest start to pick up?
Oh, I think it started to pick up about a month ago. Maybe a little bit earlier when they started contacting my office, but quite frankly, the interest has been there for quite some time because, you know, we realize that all people should be treated equally in our state.
Attorney General Bill Schuette sent a letter yesterday afternoon to all the clerks prohibiting you from issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples, even if the law were struck down. What did you make of that?
Well, what I made of that was that was pure shooting on duty politics, and the Attorney General does not make law. He interprets law, and it is my job to make sure that I follow the law, and I was prepared to do that.
I want to ask a more technical legal question involving the state attorney's presentation that maybe you can help us understand as a graduate of the MSU College of Law. When Ms. Heise requested an appeal as part of her presentation, was that a legal maneuver designed to prolong the process and effectively delay the ban?
You know, I'm not sure. I can't get into the heads of the attorneys, but, you know, I look forward to the day that all of our citizens are treated equally. And although justice was delayed, I am confident that it will not be denied.
It was kind of a technicality, though. The reason I bring it up is that it seems that the Attorney General referred to that in his letter to you, basically saying, look, this is going to be appealed, even if the judge rules for the plaintiffs. I'm just wondering if that wasn't baked in the cake. The delay wasn't baked in the cake once the state's attorneys basically said, hey, we're going to appeal this even if you vote against us, even if you decide against us.
Well, you know, it wouldn't be a surprise if the Attorney General did appeal a decision that did not go in his favor, but that's a decision that he would have to make. The fact of the matter is that letter was issued at the 11th hour with the intent to bully and intimidate local clerks, and it didn't happen in Ingham County. I was not intimidated, and I will not back down to a bully like the Attorney General.
Barb Byram is the Ingham County Clerk. Barb, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Representative Andy Shore is in his first term representing Michigan's 68th House District. The Lansing Democrat recently introduced two bills involving schooling in the state. One would allow at-risk schools to stretch instruction days throughout the calendar year. The other would allow Michigan schools to open before Labor Day. State Representative Andy Shore rejoins us here on Current State to talk about these and other recent developments. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be here, as always.
I'd like to get your take first on yesterday's no ruling from Judge Bernard Friedman involving the state's ban on gay marriage. He will allow the measure to come to trial in February, claiming the case requires a trial to be settled.
You know, I would have liked to have seen it decided yesterday. I think both parties said that it could be decided by rule of law. I'm not a judge, so that's clearly, you know, his decision, and I respect that. I think there are a lot of couples out there who love each other who have been waiting a long time, and they thought that yesterday would be the day, and now they have to wait until February, and then, you know, that's disappointing. But you know, if at the end of the day this comes out the way I hope it will, well, you know, where we can allow people to be in love and to be, you know, married and strike down a discriminatory piece in our Constitution, then, you know, waiting a few more months, I guess, won't be that bad. But it would be nice to see this decided, and I'm hopeful that it'll come out on the side of, you know, of allowing people to have love and to be able to respect their relationships.
Let's talk about the two bills you've introduced. One would allow at-risk schools to prolong instruction throughout the entire year. Why'd you file this?
You know, when I first got elected, I went to an orientation. I was talking to a gentleman named Dan DeGroe. He's the former Republican Senate Majority Leader, and he's now superintendent in the St. Clair School District. He said to me, we have abundant information and white papers and things that, especially in at-risk school districts, when kids leave in June and come back in September, they don't have the same resources as in some of the wealthier districts for educational camps and things like that. And in that 3 months, they lose so much information and knowledge that when they come back in September, they need 30 to 60 days just to catch up to where they were.
The summer slide.
That's right.
Right?
That's exactly right. And, you know, we only have 180 days, and if we're going to lose 30 to 60 days relearning information, that's a big loss for our kids, especially in at-risk areas. So I worked with him, and the idea is let's allow for schools to have a balanced calendar and to go throughout the year. Now, schools can do that now. This isn't something new. You know, in Holt, they've got two schools that are doing it. They had one, and it was so successful they opened a second one. The problem is, especially in these at-risk districts, we've got older buildings that we can't afford to convert them to put in air conditioning. If you're going to be in the summer, you have to have air conditioning. In Lansing schools, you know, it's anywhere from $600,000 to $1.2 million to convert a building for air conditioning and HVAC and other things. So the idea was, let's create a pilot program. Let's say we're going to put, say, $10 million into a fund, and we're going to allow schools to apply for that money if they're going to go all year. So it's up to the local school district to decide, you know, within discussions with their parents and teachers and things like that. But right now, they may want to do it. They just don't have they don't have $700,000 to put into putting air conditioning in an old building. And this would allow for a pilot program. My bill would allow for a pilot program to provide those resources. And I'm working with the governor's office on it. We put $10 million in it, but that's kind of a placeholder. I'm willing to use whatever the governor and the budget director are willing to provide through appropriation so that we can get Lansing and St. Clair and whatever other school districts to be able to convert the buildings they want if they choose to go all year.
Really interesting proposal. What's the response been like so far?
Tremendously positive. Tremendously positive.
You know, bipartisan?
I had four or five Republicans sign the bill. And, you know, it's, again, it's a question of the money. We put $10 million in, but, you know, people say, where's the money going to come from? And the reality is the governor does a budget every year, and he puts in one-time funding in a variety of budgets. So I'm hopeful that he's going to recommend a certain amount in the budget coming up. We'll use my legislation to implement the program, and we'll go forward, and we can get it done in time for, you know, the summer, before the summer, so we can convert some of these buildings and get going on this. Hmm.
Your other proposal would allow schools to open again before Labor Day. Why do you like that?
Well, you know, we look at right now, schools, they have a crunch time. They start in September, they end in June. Our law says they can't start before Labor Day. That was put in 8 or 10 years ago to preserve the Labor Day weekend and extended weekend for tourism. I'm supportive of tourism. But I think if, you know, my bill doesn't touch the hours. It still says 180 days and the 1,000 whatever hours. But I think if school districts want to start a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks earlier than that so that they can have more time to prepare for the meet, so that they can have more time, more vacation days, you know, throughout the year. If they want to add another week onto Christmas or onto, you know, in April, I think they should have that flexibility. And the other issue I'll raise is, you know, if you've got kids in schools, especially in older, you know, in high school and middle school, they're starting in early August for cheerleading, for football, for a band, for a variety of activities. So these kids are in the schools anyway. They might as well not just be there for extracurricular. They might as well be there getting an education. For the tourism industry, we built in and said the Friday before Labor Day has to be a day off, so they get a guaranteed 4-day vacation. And people can go up north and they can, you know, take the last weekend of the summer to swim and whatever. But it also opens up, again, another week or another 2 weeks later on in the year that people can go up north and ski and snowmobile and whatever. So it still assists tourism, but it gives the schools the ability to have flexibility on when they want to start. And as we research this, most other states have that. Some states do have a prohibition like we do, but most states have that kind of a flexibility. And I think a local control and allowing, you know, schools down in the southern part of the state, if they want to do this, in the northern part of the state, if they don't, it should be up to them.
It's interesting how that proposal kind of dovetails with the first proposal that you mentioned, because we're really talking, ultimately, we're talking about spreading out the days of instruction.
Yeah, and the you know, the Labor Day proposal really says we can use the existing infrastructure. The all-year school is more, let's balance that calendar for schools that want to do it.
And now, are tourism interests lined up more vigorously against this proposal? Is there as much support for this, or interest in this, I'll say, as the first one?
The tourism industry has come out against it, which is not a surprise, although I've actually met with a variety of folks in the tourism industry who are not as against it as their association may say. And we actually had an editorial in the Holland Sentinel and in the Alpina newspaper saying, this is not a bad idea. This is a good idea. We can survive without it because people want to come up north, and it gives them more time to come up north in the winter. Mm. So folks in those areas are supporting it, but the tourism industry has come out against it, and we just have a disagreement. And they've got a lot of numbers, and I challenge them, and I will challenge them when my bill gets a hearing to show me the increased benefit they're going to get later in the year as opposed to whatever they think they're going to lose. And recognizing that they have a 4-day weekend still built in, mm-hmm. you know, I'm willing to play with that. We can make it a 5-day weekend. I don't know, but I don't think the numbers are as drastic as what they're going to say when my bill gets a hearing.
We're talking with Democratic State Representative Andy Shore of Lansing. You're an advocate of greater education spending here in Michigan. Internal polling data in the Senate, you're in the House, but internal polling data in the Senate indicates under 50% public support for increased school spending. This is according to MERS News. Are you surprised by that number? Are you disappointed by any lack of enthusiasm for school spending coming from the public?
You know, I haven't seen the poll question. I haven't seen the poll results. I would be surprised by that. I served on the House Democrats Education Reform Task Force, and one of the things that we actually found out is that we don't actually know all of the costs associated with school activities. We don't know the total cost for busing, for special ed, for, you know, regular education. One of the things we recommended was an audit, that schools get audited to figure out how much their expenses are, and we can match the spending to those expenses. Now, we think that we're not spending enough because of the cuts that have happened over the last 2 years, over the last 2 to 3 years. In Lansing schools, They went from $7,300 per pupil to $7,100 per pupil. At the same time, we've seen buildings close. We've seen higher, more kids in classrooms and things like that. So, you know, anecdotally, we can say less money has resulted in negative things for our kids. But again, the task force we had said, let's have an audit. My superintendent, Lansing school superintendent, came up with the idea. Let's have an audit. Let's put all the costs on the table and figure out, you know, how do the spending and the cost match? And then we can show the people, this is the cost that we have. These are the things that your kids are getting. These are the costs we have. This is what we think we should be spending, especially when there are, you know, $800 million surpluses where the money is not going back into the schools. This should be our priority. And I think everybody agrees with that. Let's figure out how much we need to be spending to pay for the appropriate things for our kids.
What's the future of this audit idea?
Well, we've got legislation that we're putting in. The future is the Republicans need to agree to take this up in committee, and we'll continue to push the idea, and hopefully this legislation can become reality. But, you know, the reality is the Democrats are in the minority, and we're going to continue to push ideas, and we hope that our Republican colleagues will take them up in committee.
I want to revisit your other two proposals briefly here. Are you confident of hearings on both of those?
The tourism, my pre-Labor Day, allowing schools to open pre-Labor Day, that bill was not referred to Education Committee. It was referred to the Tourism Committee, which was interesting. But the chairman of the committee has indicated that he's planning to take it up for a hearing. So I'm pretty excited about that. You know, whether it's to bring the tourism folks in and let them beat it up or give me a chance to prove my bill is good, he has said that he's going to take it up for a hearing. And I respect Chairman Battaglia. He's from Alpena. He's a good guy. I'm not optimistic, but he has said that it's going to get a hearing. The other bill we're working on with the appropriations chairman, the balance calendar bill, the all-year school bill, I'm working on that with the appropriations chairman, which is where the bill resides now. And I've had conversations with the governor and his folks about it. And I am confident that bill will get a hearing and hopefully move. It may not be the exact same provisions, but I'm confident some version will get a hearing.
With regard to public revenue, to public spending, not just school spending, but we've seen the whole roads funding drama just drag on and on. Could you say that the larger public is simply not in a mood to be taxed more on otherwise important initiatives? I mean, has spending fatigue set in?
You know, people are always, whenever you ask people, do you want to pay more in taxes, they're always going to say, no, I don't want to pay more in taxes.
But when you ask them about the service, they tend to respond more favorably.
They do. And usually when it's funny because especially when you look at local government funding, when it's funding tied to a specific use, people are generally more supportive. So when you look at, you know, here in Lansing and other areas with millages, people tend to pass millages for specific things that they want. You know, if you say, how about your city have a general increase, generally the people don't like that
right. Because
they don't know what the money's going for.
It's mystery money.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And I see the same thing going on right now when it comes to transportation funding, roads funding, and other things. You know, I think people generally would be supportive of spending money to fix our roads. But, you know, the many proposals that we have, the most recent one, that's not the proposal. The proposal is move money from education and local governments to our roads, you know, statutorily, and then go to the ballot to backfill the education through a sales tax increase. You know, people are saying, well, if I'm going to pay 1 to 1.5% more for sales tax, what am I getting? Mm-hmm. And the answer is really, you're getting better roads, but the proposal doesn't say anything about roads. It says you're going to get this money for schools and you don't get better schools. So I think people will be leery of that. And I think that they're always going to be leery of increased taxes when they can't figure out where the money goes.
Have you had occasion to meet with incoming state treasurer Kevin Clinton yet?
I haven't. I know he's been he has been the insurance commissioner for the last few years. I have not had a chance to meet with him yet.
Well, he told us yesterday here on Current State that he's going to be meeting with a lot of state legislators, so that may happen soon. Any advice or input for him?
You know, the Department of Treasury is a tough place. There are a lot of people who are upset with folks at Treasury. I've heard, especially from our local governments, a lot of people who are upset with the way the revenue sharing or the EVIP program is working. And, you know, you see a lot of decisions from Treasury that are then countered on a different conversation. I think he needs to make sure that his folks are are in the place where he wants them to be, as they give advice to local governments, as they give to advice to residents and citizens on tax things. It's not easy to be state treasurer, and our former state treasurer learned that one. And I think whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, it's not easy. You know, I wish him the best of luck. I hope he does work with the legislature. I look forward to working with Treasury on legislative issues and bills, and we'll continue to advocate for our constituents when it comes to tax matters at Treasury.
He's told the media that he wants to work on a model that better forecasts public revenue shortages in cities and school districts further into the future. Here's how he put it yesterday here on Current State.
If we can spot financial problems ahead of time, so we're not just walking into a municipality or school district and saying, hey, you know, you guys have financial problems, we're going to name an emergency manager. If we can predict this maybe 5 years out or even longer, then the municipalities can take the steps necessary to maybe to shore up their finances, so there's no need to put an emergency manager in.
Hard to quarrel with, knowing bad news further in advance, but what do you make of that idea?
You know, it's actually funny. Before I was a legislator, I worked for the Michigan Municipal League. I worked with a lot of cities.
Right.
One of the big issues with the previous emergency manager law before the current one was that the only thing that Treasury could do was help out communities after they got into trouble. So when the municipalities talked to Treasury about the new emergency manager law, they didn't weigh in specifically, but one of the issues was, how do we get Treasury to come in and help us out years in advance before there's a problem? So what he's saying, I think, is right. It needs to be a partnership. If you have a community or a school district that sees that it's not working out real well, they should be able to go to Treasury and ask Treasury for their experts' advice and help to prevent a situation that would require emergency manager. So I think that this is what locals have been asking for a few years, you know, whether it's a 5-year budget projection or it's just we know we're going to have some issues in the next few years. I do think as a partnership between local governments and Treasury, it's a good idea. So I hope he is working with the Townships Association, the Municipal League, and the Counties Association, and the schools for a partnership. I think that's a lot more positive than the way the emergency manager law came into effect last year.
Great conversation. Andy Shore is the Democratic representative representing Michigan's 68th House District. He is a Lansing resident. Andy, continued success. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
State on 90.5 WKAR. Tonight, the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame in Lansing will induct 6 new nominees to its ranks. 2 of them are high-profile women from the Lansing area. Dr. Paula Cunningham is president and CEO of Capital National Bank in Lansing. Many people in mid-Michigan remember her 6 years as president of Lansing Community College, the school's first female president. Among other things, she's combined those skills to create financial literacy programs for area youth. Dr. Joan Jackson Johnson is the director of the Department of Human Relations and Community Services for the City of Lansing. For thousands of people, she's the compassionate face of the city as she coordinates food, shelter, and utility assistance programs for the needy. They are the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame's newest honorees. Dr. Cunningham, Dr. Johnson, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Joan, what does this honor mean for you?
It is an honor, and it has made me stop and look at my life and the contributions that I've made with the help of many other individuals. I've had many mentors during my lifetime, and I think I really appreciate being honored with the ranks of people who've done so much more than I have. And when I say that I have, I really haven't done anything alone. I grew up in Florida, where my mother believed in giving back. And certainly, although things appear to be tough during those times. You look at the economic challenges that faces our brothers and sisters here in the state of Michigan. I look at the Public Act 615 and a number of other things that impact on individuals that I call the voiceless of our community. The voiceless, the hopeless, and I'd like to be a voice for the voiceless and hope for the hopeless. And through many avenues, even before I was at the City of Lansing, that I've been given the opportunity to do some of those things to make a difference. Have I made monumental changes? I can't say that I have, but I think I've adjusted my expectations to realize that if I light one candle, you know, every now and then, the world is going to be a brighter place. And I thank, you know, all of the individuals who are involved, my family in particular, that helped to make those things happen. And working for an energetic bunny like the mayor, I mean, I'm going constantly.
Energizer bunny.
Yes. and, you know, being able to do things that I couldn't do when I was in practice. So,
Paula Cunningham, what does it mean to you to be inducted into the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame?
Oh, I, like Joan, am humbled. You know, we've come from, or at least I've come from, humble beginnings. And, you know, you never aspire to something like this. You just do what you do. You work hard. You try to give back. You try to live by the principles that you were taught as a child and growing up. And for someone to recognize those and for this to culminate, or, you know, the work to culminate in this kind of an award or recognition, really is very humbling. You know, we're not people who, you know, were necessarily born into royalty or born into with educated parents, you know, with degrees and all of that. And so to know that humble beginnings can produce, if you work hard and do what, you know, do the things that are important to you, that you can be a spotlight perhaps on the needs and the issues that are confronting our community. And somehow being that spotlight means that others' lives are better and are enriched as a result of any work at all that I've done or that has been done. It just makes you stop and pause for a moment, and certainly didn't get here alone. I could go on and on about all the people who have touched my life.
Mm-hmm. You can't have a career with responsibility, real responsibility, without making mistakes along the way either. Joan, what would you like to have the chance to do over again?
I think one of the things that I would do over is I would reverse my career. I've left the court system and the state system and worked in private practice as a psychologist for, you know, about 30-plus years, raising a family of five. We have five children, and we adopted three children with special needs. And I felt it was really important to give quality time, but I think I did my career in the reverse. You know, I'm almost 65 now, and out hustle-bustle trying to keep up with Virge Bonero is certainly a huge challenge. But I also recognize that when I was in private practice and on about 14 different boards, the changes that I felt that I wanted to be a part of making didn't come. And now in the position with the city, the institutional changes that impacts on the quality of life of people, I'm having more success in that regard. So I would probably reverse the entire cycle in terms of what I did and the timetable that it was done. And there are a few times that I'd like to take back some things that I've said and some of the tough feelings that I have for Department of Human Services right now that I'd like to pull those things back. But, you know, again, it's about human life, and sometimes we can't undo mistakes that are being made by those in charge.
Paula, what about you? What would you like to have the chance to do over?
You know, I actually don't believe in do-overs. I think that every step of this journey teaches you something if you're willing to learn, and you grow better. And sometimes you need the defeats, although, you know, you say I've had defeats, but I've never been defeated. So you just take those and you make yourself stronger. There's a lot of things in life that I've learned, a lot of mistakes that I've made, but I would not change my life. I would not have a do-over because I think it's made me a better person when I've made mistakes, when I've made errors. It's helped me to see and to guide others even. Mm. So I believe this is a journey that I'm supposed to be on. Even when I take a detour, that detour is for a reason.
We're talking with Joan Jackson Johnson, Director of the Department of Human Relations and Community Services for the City of Lansing, and Paula Cunningham, President and CEO of Capital National Bank. They are both Lansing inductees into the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame tonight. Paula, it seems that combining education and financial literacy has been a theme in your career Talk to us about that.
You know, Mark, it really is more of a continuation. I'll tell you why, because, you know, the bank that I'm working at now caters to small to medium-sized businesses. Entrepreneurism is the economic development engine for our community. It is going to help to drive the community. There are so many young people who, and even not so young people, who have not yet fulfilled their dreams. So working at a bank that has its focus on small to medium-sized businesses and making certain that we can do all that we can to be supportive of them and be the financial arm for them is really, it's a blessing for me to be able to do that. Some of those same businesses are leaders in our community and are folks who are hiring and employing workers constantly, and so having that pipeline of educated workers to help make certain that the next generation gets a chance one day to stand in the Women's Hall of Fame or gets a chance to accomplish whatever they may accomplish is part of the pipeline. That's the education is the pipeline for these businesses and for economic development. And so it is a continuum. It's not only just looking at one end of the spectrum or the other, but making certain that we feed this economic engine at the very beginning, which is education, mm-hmm. all the way through entrepreneurism so that they can start their own businesses, so that they can go on to be successful.
You've both suggested that you've had mentors in your life. Joan Jackson Johnson, who is the number one mentor that comes to mind, and why were they important?
My mother grew up in, as Paula talked about, the humble beginnings. My mother was on welfare. She raised us. And one of the things that was difficult to understand was her push for education at the time, her push to help the neighbors. I mean, sometimes we may have had one loaf of bread, and she's saying, put this in the bag for Miss Brown. I thought, what are you talking about? There are nine kids. You can't feed us. How can you feed the neighbors?
You were one of nine?
I was one of nine,
wow.
Yeah. And that was the philosophy. And we, you know, took care of the seniors in the community. And you never looked for anything in return. But sometimes when we got a little frustrated, we might climb a fence and collect a few oranges because the neighbor chose not to give us, you know, something. But I think my mother was perhaps one of the most compassionate, generous individuals from humble beginnings with nothing, mm-hmm. but raised nine kids successfully and taught us the value of sharing, the value of giving back, the value of helping other individuals. So,
this has been a great conversation. I wish we had more time to continue it. We want to congratulate both of our guests. Joan Jackson Johnson is Director of the Department of Human Relations and Community Services for the City of Lansing. Paula Cunningham is the President and CEO of Capital National Bank in Lansing. They are Lansing's inductees into the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame tonight. Congratulations to both of you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. Next month marks a milestone anniversary of one of the most horrific events in modern history. On the nights of November 9th and 10th, 1938, Nazi soldiers ransacked Jewish homes, synagogues, and hospitals across Germany and parts of Austria. The event 75 years ago came to be known as Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass. Historians widely view it as the beginning of the Holocaust. This week, students at Eaton Rapids High School are studying that awful chapter of world history. They've created their own Holocaust memorial for the public to tour. Current State's Kevin Lavery reports.
For the past 3 years, Tracy Collins has given her senior English class at Eaton Rapids High School a lesson in the humanities, specifically the humanity of one man, Nobel Peace Laureate Elie Wiesel. They begin each fall semester immersed in his harrowing tale of survival in a Nazi concentration camp. You can feel the fear in Wiesel's chilling memoir, Night.
And the students start out by reading the book. And about 3 years ago, we also visited the Holocaust Museum in Farmington Hills. And we've done that every year since. And one of the teachers who is involved in the project, Mr. Whitmeyer, in passing said, wouldn't that be really cool if we could make our own museum? And we kind of laughed it off and said, okay, well, we'll try it and see what we get out of it. And we were amazed with the result.
How much knowledge of the Holocaust does your average student here at Eaton Rapids High School have before they take part in this project?
They know a little bit because they cover it in middle school, and they've had U.S. history by the time that we get them. when I start the unit, I always start out with, all right, what do you already know? And some have seen Schindler's List. They've all seen The Boy in the Striped Pajamas. They've seen different movies. They've heard different things. They know facts about Hitler. But they don't really understand what really happened. And when they start reading the book, it's interesting because it's such a short 100-page book, and they whip through it very quickly. And the discussions that we have, I think they begin to understand what actually happened and what these people went through, instead of just putting a name on it, the Holocaust, or numbers, 6 million people died. And they get one person's story, and it's very impressive.
In a narrow hallway, a string of footprints on the floor symbolizes the death marches Jewish prisoners were forced to make. Jenna Beamer's group worked on this display.
We did the feet on the ground. You can see them here. And then we have a poster down there.
Well, I'd love to see that. Can we walk and talk and you can show me what's in your display?
Yeah. So the feet on the ground represent 1 foot equals 30 miles. And we have 15 feet, so it adds up to about like 400 some odd miles. And it's the distance from Auschwitz to Buchenwald, which they did in fact walk from Auschwitz to this other camp called Buchenwald.
And we are now coming upon that poster you talked about. This looks like a political border map of something. I'm assuming this is Poland or parts of Poland?
This map is actually the outline of Greater Germany.
Which, of course, in World War II, Poland was essentially an annexation of Germany.
Yeah, it was.
So there's Auschwitz there and Dachau and Buchenwald. Mm-hmm. Yet there's also some other ones. I'm having difficulty pronouncing some of these. I'm not even going to attempt to. But the idea is that there were many, many camps, not just the main ones people think about.
Yeah, there are a lot of sub-camps that a lot of people don't know about. Like, I had never really heard of Gross Rosen or Mauthausen. I've never really even heard about Flossenbürg either. But after doing this project, I learned about a lot of sub-camps that I hadn't known about before.
Jenna, what does it mean to you as you're putting all this together and you're doing the research and you're probably seeing films about this? What are you feeling when you put this all together and you see this coming together?
It's definitely heartbreaking to know that there were people out there that actually went through this and people that conducted this kind of stuff. It's a lot to take in, definitely, but I think it gives us a lot to learn about, like responsibilities towards other people.
Just outside, Thomas Bell explains the strikingly realistic replica he and a friend spent a month to build.
How did you come upon the idea to build a concentration camp-style cattle car?
We decided to start building one to do something a little different from last year's. And we decided to do something a little overboard that no one's done before, just to get something else for people to look at when they come in.
This looks like it used to be a hay wagon. You've got some rusty hinges on here and some old faded planks of wood. You've got some chicken wire here at the top. It's pretty realistic, if you ask me.
Yeah, we tried to make it look, close. We couldn't do it exactly, but we tried to make it, kind of close to what the other ones looked like with the discolored boards and the old barn door on the front. So.
And what do you want me, as your visitor to your school, to see and feel about what you've done?
I guess just see kind of the build of them and how small of an area, and they packed so many people inside of them. And kind of think about what they had to go through during the time they had to be in the train cars and being transported to the concentration camps.
The image of the crowded cattle car is a potent one for Adam Parker, who's done his share of Holocaust research.
They would pack them really to the point where there was no movement. You couldn't move. It was usually about 100 people per car. It's like a regular cattle car, so they really stuffed them. And they would move days on end without stopping. There was usually small openings for air, and they'd have a bucket in there for your waste, human waste. And it was really horrible conditions.
Many people suffocated or were crushed to death even before they got to a concentration camp.
That is true. It's been documented even in like the book Night by Elie Wiesel. He talks about how he saw that firsthand in one of his counts.
What do you want people in the community who come to see your display to come away with? What's the takeaway you're hoping will resonate with them?
Me personally, I hope that when they come and they go through this and they leave, I hope it leaves a part in them that says that we can never have anything like this happen again. this is, you know, it's unexcusable.
The Eaton Rapids High School Holocaust Memorial will be on public display this afternoon from 4 o'clock until 7:30. Holocaust survivor Jeanette Olson will speak and sign her book tonight at the high school. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And you're listening to 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Singing legend Johnny Mathis comes to East Lansing on Thursday night. His career began at age 19 and has spanned decades worth of popular favorites. He's especially known for his holiday music, and his newest release features Christmas duets and will be out at the end of the month. WKAR's Melissa Benmark spoke with Johnny Mathis and asked him, why so many Christmas albums?
Over the years, I recorded a lot of Christmas music. Initially, I did it to sort of pay tribute to my mom, who always made Christmas really special for my seven brothers and sisters and I. And this is another effort to record some more Christmas music. It really kind of took off, and people have told me over the years how much the music that I've done for Christmas has meant to them. So I got into the studio, and we went to Nashville with a wonderful producer and a lot of very famous singers, Vince Gill and his wife.
Amy Grant.
And several other wonderful singers. And we did some duets. And also, I got a chance to once again honor my mom by singing some beautiful Christmas music. So I'm looking forward to my next few concerts around that time to sing some more Christmas music.
You are so well known for your Christmas albums. When you're the guy that everyone listens to in order to get into the Christmas spirit, what do you listen to around the holidays? What's your go-to record?
Oh, gosh. I was part of an album years ago, maybe about 10 or 12 years ago, and I can't remember right now the name of the guy who produced it and also got all of the people together for the album. David Foster, that's his name. And it turned out to be quite a successful Christmas album. But anyway, it was a lot of fun. And on the album, there were several of my favorite singers in the world singing Christmas music. That is the album that I keep on constantly. I am a part of it, of course, and I was very proud of what we did. But the David Foster Christmas album is the one that I think I play most at holiday time.
One of the people you've said inspired you was Lena Horne, and I've sometimes wondered if being inspired by a vocalist who is of the opposite sex really stretches you, because you can't actually do exactly what they do just by virtue of how the voices are different. So you're kind of forced to find out what you can do that will convey the song in the same way that you like what they're doing that conveys the song.
I think the thing that I took away from Lena Horne was her concentration when she performed. Her effort was totally concentrated in every nuance of every song that she sang. And that's the thing that fascinated me. She sang great songs. And over the years, I got to meet her and to speak to her a little bit about what she did and the process that she did. And she told me that on many occasions, the songs that I was hearing that she recorded and performed were songs that she had worked on and practiced for 2-3 years before she performed them. And things like that always fascinated me because that's exactly what happened to me over the years, is I worked and worked on certain songs and never really felt comfortable performing them until, you know, 2 or 3 years later. The thing that I still get frustrated about is I have to record music sometimes before I really, really, really know it.
Right, deadlines.
Yeah, and that bothers me a lot, because years later I listen to it and I go, oh, gosh, I wish I'd done this or I wish I'd done that. But the spontaneity, I guess, is sometimes is the thing that overrides my expectations.
You have recorded so many albums and so many songs, but have you ever found one that you really wanted to do and it just always confounded you? You just could never quite get it to where you wanted it?
Oh, gosh. The one that sticks in my mind, it's not an album per se, but it's a song, Moon River, that my buddy Henry Mancini and I became good buddies at a very early age at the World's Fair in Seattle. And I invited Henry for the first time to go on stage and perform some of the music that he had recorded. And it just changed his whole life. He was so excited to actually play his music for people in concert. And of course, so we became really good buddies. And over the years, I recorded so much of his music. But the one song that I did before I really kind of knew it, I recorded his iconic, Moon River. And I don't think I did it very well. I spoke to Andy Williams, of course, who did do it very well, and told him how disappointed I had been over the years that I hadn't sung it better or done the production a little bit better. But that's the one thing, because of my closeness to Henry, I wanted it to be so special, and it wasn't. But I tried to make up for it over the years by singing possibly every song he ever wrote.
One thing that people may or may not know about you is that you were an outstanding high school track athlete, record high jumper, might have gone to the Olympics, but decided to pursue singing. Do you think that there's a correlation between being physically fit and being a successful singer?
Oh, I think you can't go wrong keeping yourself physically fit. About 25 years ago, I was on the golf course with one of the iconic physical fitness gurus, a son of a diminutive little man, but he had a television program for years on physical fitness.
And it wasn't Jack LaLanne.
Jack LaLanne.
Yeah.
That was him, yeah. Anyway, I did a golf tournament, celebrity golf tournament, and he was my partner. And he congratulated me on the fact that I seemed to be in pretty good physical shape, and he said, how's your workout routine? And I said, well, I don't have one because I don't exercise. And he says, oh, John, he says, you must promise me that you'll exercise. He says, it's the only thing that's going to keep you in good shape and keep you motivated as you get a little bit older. And he was absolutely right. I had a couple of situations where I had surgery, hip surgery and back surgery. And according to instructions that I got afterwards were some exercise routines, and I just sort of kept it up. And then I met a guy on the golf course who was a kinesiologist, and I had no idea what that meant. But anyway, I found out later, but it has a lot to do with exercise and the movement of the body. And I started a routine, an hour and 15 minute routine, and that was 25 years ago, and I've been keeping it up 5 days a week, lo, these many years. That is the thing that keeps me feeling good. And just, I don't think, no way in the world that I could get myself up to perform and sing if I didn't feel good. So I would say to anybody who's going to do any kind of performance, that a good exercise routine will be a godsend to them.
You inspire me. I'm going to have to get on the bike when I get home.
And you know what? It's never too late.
Oh, yeah. That's good advice. That is very good advice. Well, one final question for you before we let you go. You've sold over 350 million records, Lifetime Achievement Award in 2003, awarded by the Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences, the Grammy Hall of Fame, and of course being, as you would say, the iconic voice of Christmas music for many generations. What in the world do you aspire to after achieving all that?
The thing that I think most people in my situation have in mind is, when is it going to end, or is it going to end, or what can I do to prolong it? Those are the things that go through my mind. I listen to my voice, and of course it's quite different now from what it was when I was a kid. I started recording when I was 19 years old, so I play some of those records and go, oh my goodness, I don't think I can do that anymore. And so what you do is you find out what you can do and try to keep that as a motivation. And that's what I do now. I also think that the fact that that people hear my music at Christmas time, it kind of refreshes their memory about my career. And so I do have an audience to sing for, and that is the thing that really motivates me. I know that I'm going to go on stage and sing, and I have to make sure that I can sing. And every morning that I wake up, that's what I think about. How is the voice?
Well, Mr. Johnny Mathis, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Please have snow and mistletoe and presents on the tree. Christmas Eve will find me
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll continue our local election coverage with the at-large council race in Lansing, incumbent Brian Jeffries and candidate Judy Brown Clark. Join us, and we'll hear the music of Australian blues musician Harper, who's playing at East Lansing's Pump House this weekend. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.